Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, my name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Every week, we want to have honest conversations about what it means to be in one of the sector's least understood, yet most critical roles. Today, I will be speaking with the advancement leadership of St. Augustine's University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Their team has graciously agreed to host my seminar on April 26th. Please help me welcome Dr. Steve Harrison, Vice President of Institutional Advancement, and Candace Murray, Director of Development. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jason. How are you today?
Good. I'm really good. Would the two of you just mind quickly introducing yourselves?
Sure. Well, as you said, I'm Stephen Harrison. I serve as the Vice President for Institutional Advancement and Development here at St. Augustine's University. I've been here at the university for the past 5 years and been in and around fundraising for the last 25 years.
And I am Candace Murray, Director of Development. I've been with the university for 6 years and have been in the world of philanthropy for about 4 years now.
Wow. So we sort of have someone, Steve, you've been in the field just a little bit longer than I have. And Candace, you're relatively by comparison, a relatively newcomer. So talking to you both will be a helpful observation for us to have during this conversation this morning. First thing I do want to ask, though, of both of you is, seeing as I'm coming down there to host my seminar, one of the things I like to ask folks who've agreed to host this is, what is it that I need to understand in advance of my visit about philanthropy in the Raleigh-Durham area? What are the opportunities and challenges that a local area like yours might be encountering that a guy like me who's speaking and providing advice and counsel needs to understand?
Well, Jason, I think there are a couple things. I think that the Triangle area, the Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill area, is a great place to have this discussion. It's a great space for fundraising and philanthropy. In addition to the universities that we have in the Triangle area, there are many nonprofit organizations and foundations that call their home here in the Research Triangle area. And I think that all of these nonprofit entities and universities that perform fundraising will really benefit from having someone of your talent, someone of your exposure to come into our area and have this robust discussion. Our university is a independent college, and we are a part of what's known as the North Carolina Independent College and Universities. And so we have already space kind of carved out with our fellow institutions where we talk about fundraising. But here's an opportunity to open this up to other nonprofits, to have them join this discussion and talk about the important areas that are here in North Carolina for fundraising.
Yeah, so.
And I think along with that, Jason, there are a number of universities in the Raleigh-Durham Triangle area. So just the advancement teams alone would benefit from the information that you're coming to share.
Yeah, so Candace, question for you. What does it look like for younger fundraising professionals in your area? Are there groups that, I mean, do you know your other peers that are doing those same work?
It is an effort to get to know your peers. There are not specific groups, but you really have to go network and find your tribe, if you will.
Right.
I do a great deal of professional development outside of the Triangle. But inside, everybody's kind of in their little clusters, and you really have to work your way in to be able to talk to your colleagues, especially of the younger generation.
So, Candace, one of the questions I like to ask folks like yourself, unlike Steve and I have, we've decided that fundraising was our career path. So he and I have both been in this path. We've been down this path for more than two decades. Are you at that place where you have decided, yes, fundraising fits for me, and this is what I'm going to do for my entire career?
Well, that's a great question, Jason. Absolutely. I am at a pivotal point where I have accepted and wholeheartedly love philanthropy and want to make that my career. So I'm really, starting in 2019, jumping into more networking opportunities and larger professional developments outside of the state, and really looking into accreditation and joining associations as well. So I'm really putting my time, talent, and treasures into making this my profession, although I landed in it by accident. So when I reached out to you on LinkedIn, it was simply to expand my network and have a wonderful seminar come right here in our backyard on campus.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. So, Candace, one of the things that you suggested, and it sounds like Dr. Harrison has some great ideas and some opinions about that, to sort of tee up our conversation, I will say that of the we have done 40-plus conversations of this sort on the podcast, and we have yet to have a conversation about the role of board members. And so, Candace, you and I agreed that maybe we would have a conversation that would sort of zero in on the expectations and the opportunities that we have for board members in the nonprofit space. So, Dr. Harrison, would you sort of mind just sort of teeing up that part of the conversation and just sort of share your thoughts from a big level of what is it that we should be expecting of board members when it comes to the various roles that we're all playing in the nonprofit space?
Sure. Thanks, Jason. So when I started to think about what would be a good topic for us to discuss, and something that has been on my mind for a very long time has been the role of board members in the nonprofit sector and how do they intersect and help with philanthropy and fundraising. And I think one of the things that drew me to this topic was I was placed on my first board, and I use the word placed, on my first board at the age of 27. It was the board of a nonprofit organization in an urban city that really had a lot of needs for programming and had a lot of needs for funding. And so as a new younger, probably at that time, one of the youngest members on the board, that role was kind of placed on me. And so I was new to the sector, new to the idea of being on a board and participating on a board. So I had to kind of blaze a trail. Now, I made 100 mistakes until we finally found a way for us to raise dollars, to enhance the programs, to make the overall nonprofit a success. So one of the things that's just been on my mind for so long has been we place individuals on boards. We ask individuals to serve on boards. We select individuals to be on boards, but we don't provide in many instances a lot of training for them. And it's training in a couple of spaces, I think. It's training for what's your role as a board member? How do you become an effective board member and not get in the way of the organization that you're trying to serve and give advice to? But then, you know, your most important role is that of philanthropy and fundraising. So how do you fundraise? Who do you approach? How do you approach them? What's your message? There's all these topics that a board member has to be able to understand and digest. But I think it's incumbent upon the leadership of the various nonprofits to provide that education or facilitate the provision of that education if they can't provide it to make a successful board member.
Yeah. So that comment, that the idea that you had to make 100 mistakes in order to really learn what you had to learn. Can an institution of your size, can an institution like St. Augustine's actually afford to have board members on there making 100 mistakes?
No, you can't. You can barely afford to have them make one mistake, to be honest with you, because you're competing for the interest a lot of industrial philanthropists. You're competing yeah. for the interests of corporate foundations.
Yeah.
You're competing with the interests of not only universities here in our area, but healthcare foundations and healthcare development teams that are trying to raise money for the various hospital foundations that are in our area. So you really can't. That's why I think it's really incumbent upon the leadership of any nonprofit to really make sure that your selection process is top notch when you're recruiting and trying to sign board members. But also, once you get that person on board, that you give them a good educational foundation on fundraising and philanthropy and how best to go about getting dollars for that nonprofit that they're serving. And that's a tall order. Because sometimes depending on your leadership of the nonprofit or your leadership of the organization, they may not have the tools in their toolkit to provide that training. And that's when I think it's best to reach outside of your four walls, so to speak, and find a consultant, find an organization, find a trade association that can assist you in providing that training. And then once you have that training, I like the pre and post model. So, of course, you go into a session for training and you give them kind of a pretest to find out what their literacy is, what they know, what their areas of strength are. But then it also, after the end of that training, kind of give them a post follow up to see if they've actually grasped the information. Because sometimes you can hear a concept. You can think you understand the concept, but you don't really get the concept in order to operationalize it. So I think that kind of pre and post method that we use here helps to make sure that your board member understands the concepts that you're trying to teach them and get them to understand.
Yeah, so I have to imagine that for organizations that expect the same prioritization of board members in terms of involvement in philanthropy, that an organization like yours certainly allows, I have to imagine that the vice president of St. Augustine's yourself is involved in actively interacting with board members. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Yeah. So what
I have, yeah. our board, no, I was just going to say our board is close to 20 individuals. I work very closely with all of them, but I work specifically Ms. Mary and myself with our development subcommittee, and that subcommittee really helps to drive the overall direction of the board when it comes to fundraising. And they really support kind of the work that we do and make it easy for us.
Yeah. So in hindsight, looking back on that board, that smaller, that probably less, presumably less mature organization that you started with when you were younger, I have to imagine that you would agree. Well, here, let me just pose the question. Would it similarly be your observation that in smaller shops, we struggle to elevate the chief development officer, the person in a role like yours, to the point where they can play a meaningful role with the board, and consequently, we can't use that, we can't set the expectation for philanthropy to be a priority on their, within their sort of quote-unquote job description? Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
Yeah, no, it makes all the sense in the world. And so over my years in this arena, you're absolutely right. When you think about the young development officer that's coming in and you think of the supports that they need to be successful, you really want to give them those supports early in their career so that they don't get discouraged. And you want to set expectations that are meaningful, but yet not unattainable. Because, you know, as I think about this as a career, especially for our younger generations that are coming, the Miss Candace Marys of the world, you really want to make this road a lot easier for them than I think it has been the road that I traveled. The road that I traveled had a lot of potholes in it, because the career, you were seen as a beggar more so than going out. Philanthropy is a new word, if we want to be honest with ourselves. I get hung up in the fundraiser because that's the world I really grew up in. But this is philanthropy when you think about it. Time, talents, and treasures is a new term in the last 15 years, but it means a lot. When I first started, when I say the potholes, it was, hey, here are 10 people that are in the metropolitan area where I was. I got a list of here are 10 people that we think can help the organization go out and get money for them, without any guidelines on, you know, what does a successful ask look like? How much are we asking the person for? What's a reasonable dollar figure? So the whole prospect research was done, but it was really done at a rudimentary level. We didn't have the computer systems that we have now. We didn't have the information systems. We didn't have the World Wide Web. We had connections, handshakes, word of mouth, and you hope that the person you were seeing across really liked you, because if they liked you, they'd probably donate to the organization. If they didn't, you'd probably never see them again and never get a return phone call from them. So I say all that to say, I think we've got to realize that the next generation that are coming behind us, we've got to make this career path an interesting one, an easier one for them, and give them the tools that they need to be extremely successful.
Yeah. So let's sort of unpack that some more since you've gone down that path, because that's obviously a lot of what we're going to be talking about in my seminar. So Dr. Hairston, when you're interviewing another Candace, when you say, okay, I need another member of my team that looks like Candace, what are those top two or three things that you're looking for? Maybe from somebody who doesn't have any experience at all. What is it you're looking for?
Well, I think if it's someone that's fresh, let's say they have less than a year, maybe less than 2 years in this career field, then what I'm really looking for are their interpersonal relationships. What organizations have they been a part of over the, either in their undergraduate or graduate careers or just coming out of school? What have they been involved in where they may not have an opportunity to interact with someone, to ask them for money or to steward them or to develop that prospect research? I think this is fundraising and philanthropy is all about relationships. It's all about interpersonal relationships. So you want to make sure that you have someone that is upbeat, bright, cheery, but can understand and pick up very quickly nuances in conversations, body languages, things of that nature, so that they know when they can pivot on a conversation, stay in a conversation, participate more in a conversation. And then I look for individuals that are kind of well-rounded. I love a liberal arts student, someone who has had an opportunity in their undergraduate career to experience a lot of different and diverse academic disciplines. Have been involved in their community, have participated in organizations. I think that gives you someone that shows an interest in just kind of getting out of the house, getting off their tablet, getting off their phone, and kind of interacting, because the interaction is very important. It's still important, and I can't preach that enough to the next generation that's coming along.
You know, I listen very closely. When somebody says something like, I love a liberal arts student, when you put the word love in front of something, you know, that's one of the things that good fundraisers pick up on, is we listen to language. And what you're saying there, Dr. Hairston, about the idea of loving a liberal arts student is you're describing that research that folks like yourself, me and you have been reading for years about these ideas like these curious chameleons, these people who want to know and understand sort of the diversity of our world, which is generally what a liberal arts student is all about. So they're very adaptable. They're very curious. Candace, I'm curious. Are you a curious? Do you know what I mean when I say a curious chameleon?
Well, I'm using the context clues, and based on his giggle, I am curious to a fault.
Okay.
I think I might ask rapid fire questions of Dr. Hairston more than he likes to answer. So my background is liberal arts, and I'm always looking to learn new things, and I'm very observant of just human nature.
Yeah.
So one thing that has helped me in learning this profession is just my paying attention to people and how they look, act, and feel in certain environments, so I can gauge if they're ready for an ask, or if it's just a smile and coffee, or if it's a follow up or leave me alone, maybe
right.
Next year. Curiosity is definitely key in the name of the game.
So you just heard Dr. Hairston describe the characteristics that he's looking for. Of those characteristics, or maybe some of the other expectations that you know that he has for you as a member of his team, what one of those characteristics sort of makes you the most nervous or scares you the most?
I would have to say personally, the adaptability. That's something that Dr. Harrison works with me on regularly. I'm your type A personality who's very organized and likes a calendar. and keeps him where he needs to be. So yeah. I'm getting better at pivoting quickly and adjusting to what may come. But it still gives me, I need a little time to shake it off and recover. So we're working on my recovery time and shortening that so I can just go with the flow and be where we need to be.
Now, is that pivoting? Internal. So there's internal pivoting. So there's the pivoting that you have to do in the office when you're organizing events or something. But what Dr. Harrison and I have learned in our 2 decades of raising money is that the pivoting that's oftentimes the most expected of us is the pivoting when you're out in the field with a major donor. Is that the type of pivoting that we're talking about? Or are you doing that type of frontline work enough to know that it's oftentimes the major donor that requires the biggest pivots of us?
That's absolutely right. I'm able to pretty much cater to our potential and our ongoing donors. They have a plethora of needs and requirements.
Yeah.
And I like to pride myself on my customer service. So that I can work with, but the internal pivot is a little more difficult to digest sometimes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think it's one thing. You know, it's the internal dynamics that I think are frustrating and challenging, but I think the place where we become extremely valuable, and I think Dr. Harrison would support this, is that ability to be flexible and adaptable out in the field. It's one thing to have tension inside the office, but those major donors who are writing you guys very generous checks, that's where it counts the most. Am I speaking well for you, Dr. Harrison?
No, I think you are. And so it's really interesting we're having this conversation today. The last 2 weeks have been kind of major for us, away from campus, kind of out in the field with our major donors and vendors. We've been paying them visits. We had a major event last week. We're in our basketball conference. We hold a fundraiser at the actual basketball conference. And so at that event, we have about 225 people there, our major vendors, our major donors. And so we had to do some pivoting on site with those donors because there's some certain expectations that our donors see that they want a part of that when they may see another donor get something that they don't. And they want to know, how do I get to that level? And they want to know that right there, that morning, that instant. And so while you may be able to have that conversation, you really don't want to have that conversation on the spot like that, but you're almost forced into the conversation. And then once you have it, you have to have it very quickly because this is a very intense 2-hour event that we're having. Once they get it, I think they get it, and then they want to participate right then. So you have to be very flexible to give them the avenue to participate because they may want the recognition that they didn't know was coming to the next level at that particular event. They want that recognition then and there. Now, I'm not one to turn down your check or your pledge or your donation, but you just got to put all that in the proper context. And sometimes you have to be extremely flexible on the fly. And that's when we talk about our external pivoting. Because we have one direction that we are kind of moving in with that particular donor to move them to the next level kind of in an orderly fashion so that things don't seem like helter skelter. And then they may want to get ahead of us, and then we've got to kind of slow them down, kind of get them where they need to be so that we know what's going on internally with our operations, but give them the feeling and the appearance that they're at that next level right then and there. That has been an extremely good challenge for us. But we've learned in our office to become extremely flexible when it comes to that type of pivoting out in the field.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful conversation. I don't like to try to keep you guys more than for about a half hour. But I'm really looking forward to being with you folks at the end of April. And Candace, thank you again for reaching out to me and saying, hey, would you like to come down to Raleigh? I have not been in the Raleigh-Durham area to present the How Fundraising Really Works seminar. So I'm very, very anxious to get down there. And I'm going to be talking to lots of other people to ensure that I'm doing my part. Candace and Dr. Hairston, if somebody wants to reach out to you, if they're anxious to, they've heard something that we've talked about today and they say, hey, I want to follow up with them and have a conversation, how might be the best way for them to do that?
Absolutely. And Jason, we're more than happy to host you, and I'm looking forward to this connection and the partnership. If anyone would like to follow up and reach out to us, you can reach me via email at crmurray, M-U-R-R-A-Y, at sp-aug.edu. That's crmurray@st-aug.edu.
And Jason, I'd just like to say we really, as Candace said, we really look forward to you coming here to the Raleigh-Durham area. We really look forward to you visiting our campus and visiting our shop. And we just can't wait till you get here.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.